and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and due to work, Joel isn't here, but with me instead is a frequent guest, MVP, super fan, I don't know, but Marcus Penn.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So this episode is a special one for April. We're going to talk about Ivan Dixon. I'm going to talk about one movie he was in and one movie he directed. And Ivan Dixon, well, I used to think people knew who he was, but talking to my aunts and my parents, I was like, okay, maybe it's like only cinephiles kind of know who he is, because I thought he was a more famous person, but not as much as I thought. But
not because of television, I assumed, just because of the
I talked to my dad and some of my mom's sisters, and they're like, they don't remember him on Hogan's Heroes at all.
Really? That's, well, wait, if you don't, how old are your parents? Because you're kind of younger than me.
Early 60s.
Okay, I mean, yeah, like, my dad was in his 70s, and he knew Ivan, well, we'll get into why he knew Ivan Dixon pretty well, but, that's weird, because my wife's mom, she's in her 60s, and I told her the Ivan Dixon story that I'll be telling on this podcast, and she was like, oh, like, she knew him well, I guess, I don't know,
Yeah, my mom knew who he was, but she watches, like, TMC and TMC, the movie network.
Right, yeah, right, TCM. Right.
TCM, that's it, yeah. She watches, like, that all the time, so, like, my mom is aware, and like, I told my dad, like, oh, yeah, and he directed a lot of TV, you know, like, what shows, like, if you watch TV in the late 70s and 80s, you watch something he directed. Yeah. Very prolific. Yeah, and, like, I guess, like, the biggest thing Ivan Dixon did would have been A Raisin in the Sun, would probably be the...
Sure.
And he's not even, like, one of the stars, because he is still pretty... It's still pretty early on for him.
Mm-hmm. But I also think, too, it could be culturally, because, like I'm saying, like, my grandmother, who was born in 1920, mm-hmm. my dad, who was born in 1945, they were essentially, I think, I guess it doesn't have anything to do with class so much, but I think if you were black and you had a television during, you know, the 50s, maybe the 60s, I guess that kind of meant a little something status-wise. And I think there's always that thing, especially back then, any black person that was on anything slightly major... Mm-hmm. Black viewers, like, just knew them by name. It was just kind of a big deal to see someone, you know, on a show like Hogan's Heroes or just on television, period. So, like, even, like, a supporting, you know, like I said, it's like my mom, my mm-hmm. dad, my grandmother, or just people of that era, black people of between, born to the 20s through, I guess, maybe the 40s or 50s, just kind of knew him by name. And yeah. Other Ivan Dixons, just like, oh, a black person? Yeah, no, we know who he is, because it's just kind of like a sense of pride, I think.
Yeah, and he's also in a couple of Twilight Zones. He's in, I think, one of the best
ones. Oh, that I did not know.
I think it might be one of the best ones, but, like, no one really talks about it. The Big Tall Wish, which is about a little black kid in, like, I guess it's supposed to be, like, maybe Harlem. It's a vague New York neighborhood. It's never really specified. And he wishes that his favorite boxer, who is his neighbor, played by Ivan Dixon, wins, like, the title match, and he goes from, like, believing in succeeding and, like, you know, and making something out of himself into, like, giving up. And so, like, through, like, weird vague magic, the magic doesn't really make sense, but he loses a fight. And so, like, it kind of alters reality, and it's just kind of, it's about, like, inequality and a whole bunch of stuff, and it's very, ahead of time for Twilight Zone, because, like, well, it's TV.
Sure, sounds it, yeah.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool, because it's almost an all-black cast, and it's just not really commenting on race. It's just, like, it's not, like, making a big point of, like, we have a black cast. It's, like, it just happens to be like that.
Damn, you know, it's interesting. I've always felt that, like, even today in 2020, that, like, that's what the groundbreaking thing is. Like, if you just have an all or majority black cast, don't make the story about race. Just, hey, these people happen to be of some kind of color, and it's just about what the story is. It has nothing to do with race. And I think people still don't get that. I think people still think, oh, we're going to make this movie about race and racism, and that's groundbreaking. It's like, not really. It's funny, because it's just like you're saying, it's more groundbreaking for an episode of Twilight Zone, which I'm assuming was in the 60s at some point, to just, you know, be about, you know,
it's a boxing
not
story,
about race,
basically.
But have a black. Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah.
And which is, and I think they won some NCAA, no, fuck, I always mess up, NAACP award for it. And a couple seasons later, they did an episode where they had a couple white people in brown face playing Mexican. So it's kind of a one-time thing for them. But, you know, that was TV of the time. But Ivan Dixon was in another episode that's not as good, it's kind of forgotten. But, so Ivan Dixon, he was a big deal at the time. And I guess first we want to talk about the movie that he was in. And, I never heard of this movie until, I think it was maybe like you or Tume mentioned it on, Zebras. Mm-hmm. Or on Twitter or something, Nothing But a Man, and I'm kind of blown away. I didn't know what to expect. I went in knowing nothing, and it feels like this almost like a French New Wave. Like it predates Story of a 3-Day Pass, and it feels like it's definitely like a in the same vein of that.
Well, a lot of that could have to do with just the fact, you know, the director. Being European himself, and probably, you know, his influences, you know, him being German, and, you know, getting his education in England, London, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So there could have been that. Because the director himself, I didn't even think to even look up the director until well after seeing the movie. It was Chris Funderburg. I mean, I saw the movie because of Funderburg. And then he was explaining to me just like the director's whole backstory, just like as a kid, you know, he had to leave Berlin because of the Nazis and all. He had an interesting, you know, childhood, an interesting adolescence. And it's it was really cool. Just that connection to like him telling a story about just kind of like, you know, the black struggle in the South, which always fascinates me, just like a non-American person, whether it be Lars von Trier, even though he's got some questionable whatever when he tells stories like Manderley or Dogville. But it is always interesting when like a European filmmaker tells a story, like a truly American story, you know, rooted in race and racism too. It's like, because what do you know about that? Don't get me wrong, Europe has their own form of racism with black people, specifically African or Caribbean immigrants, but it's a whole other ball game in America, and then an even more different ball game when we're talking about like the Deep South, you know, like because the Northeast, from like Maine down to like Philadelphia, they have their own different brand of racism. Like the Midwest has their brand of racism, and like the South is kind of the genesis or mecca, if I may. I don't mean to disrespect the term mecca when relating it to racism, but you know. So,
like, one of the first things that stuck out to me in Nothing But a Man was seeing Yaphet Kotto so young.
Yeah.
I think the earliest thing I'd seen him in before this must have been like Friday Foster or like some other blaxploitation movie. And sure. Like seeing him like young and thin, it's like, oh, he was like, he wasn't always 45 years old.
Yeah, that's funny. You know what's also interesting about Nothing But a Man? It's an early role of, I could just look it up. It's right in front of me. She's young, obviously, in Nothing But a Man, but the actress who plays the Oracle in the Matrix movie, she's Ivan Dixon's stepmom in the movie. You know what? Let's not do this. Yeah, Gloria Foster.
Okay, the name looked familiar, but I didn't look her up. But like
If I'm not mistaken, I think she passed away after the first Matrix. I know she's not in the third one. I don't really remember that movie too well, but she passed away definitely after the first Matrix. But,
She was replaced by, like, another person.
The character actress from, To Sleep With Anger and, the mother in To Sleep With Anger. And she was on episodes of A Different World. She's like the soft, light spoke. She has that high pitched voice, then she's like soft spoken. Mm-hmm. Damn it. What is her name? Ah. Yeah, that's what she was replaced by. Hold on. Let me look up her name. Because she is. Because I think character actresses often get overlooked, and black character actresses like a Loretta Devine or someone like that. Hold on. Yeah, Mary Alice. Mary Alice. She was replaced by Mary Alice.
Okay. But Gloria Foster, she was married to Clarence Williams III, who we just talked about in our Tales from the Hood episode.
Wait, was she?
Yeah.
I'm just tempted to make a tasteless joke, but I guess my wife is white, so I'm allowed to do that. But yeah. I honestly thought Clarence Williams only was attracted to one type of woman, so that's why I reacted the way I did. I mean, his history only says that, so.
Yeah. Well, they got divorced after, 17 years, looks like. 18 years.
Wow. Yo, I did not know that. Wow. Okay. That's it. You learn something new every day.
Yeah. And also, Julius Harris is in Nothing But a Man, playing Duff's dad. And it took me a while to realize who it was, because, just like Yoffa Kotto, I'm used to seeing him, middle-aged and older.
Yeah,
and like the voice and less like the face, like Julius Harris has a very very recognizable face.
Yeah,
and like the thing with his arm, it feels like almost like a precursor to him in Live and Let Die, where he has like the robot arm, the robot hand that uses to like open doors and stuff. And
yeah.
But so the movie itself is just like a slice of life. It's about like what it's like to be to live with racism and in the Deep South in the 60s, and it feels very of the moment of the time, but not in a bad way.
Oh, sure, of course.
Yeah, and it's like they mentioned like the Freedom Riders and like and like other stuff like that, but like it feels like a piece of like American history, but like from perspective of a European.
Exactly. And don't get me wrong, there's how do I say this? The movie obviously obviously things concerning racism in the film, but a lot of it it's like day-to-day life of black life outside of just racism, which kind of like it's like a precursor for like a lot of Charles Burnett's work. I mean, we were just talking about To Sleep With Anger, but not even so much that, but something like Killer of Sheep, where it's just like black neighborhood, black day-to-day life. Yeah, there's a couple of... Well, in Killer of Sheep, it's just one little thing about race. But other than that, the movie isn't about race or like just, you know, like elements of, say, Devil in a Blue Dress. I mean, obviously that movie deals with race and racism at a certain point, but there's just the neighborhood that Denzel Washington lives in. You know, my dad used to watch Devil with a Blue Dress, and he used to always say, like, I would have loved to see a movie just about that neighborhood, just like the black middle class or even the black lower middle class, where it's just kind of day-to-day life of like working class black people, which is kind of like where my dad and people like him came from. And Nothing But a Man is very much like that, just like black workers having jobs and then like the struggle of trying to find another job and all that stuff. So it definitely was ahead of its time. And when it comes, especially now when you have popular movies like, say, like, you know, a Queen and Slim or movies of that ilk, it's kind of like movies like Nothing But a Man are kind of ahead of it. They're still ahead of their time 60 years later, which isn't exactly a good thing, if you ask me.
Oh no, definitely not. It's like this movie just brought up so much, just like for me, like memories of like hearing about my dad's from West Virginia, and like his family still lives there, and he's like the sixth of eight kids, and like the scene, like the job struggles, like that's what like my grandfather went through, and like and his dad was a pig farmer, so he was doing okay, but a lot of. About this, a lot of my family's like, this is what I imagine, like, what is this life was like for them. This, like, if you speak up too much, you're gonna lose your job. And like, my grandfather was, he definitely had a bad temper. Like, his nickname was Red.
Oh.
Because, He's a little darker skinned, but like it's not because of his red hair, because like he was a it didn't take much to get him angry. But like he worked at the same place for the Greenbrier. He was a basically worked as like a housekeeper at the Greenbrier Hotel in West Virginia, which is real famous, for like I think 50 years or 45 years. Mm-hmm. But like,
wait, you said Virginia or West Virginia?
West Virginia.
Wow, I'm just—it's just like it's kind of dangerous to be a black person to have a short temper in West Virginia during that time. That's a powder keg.
Oh yeah, I know. Like I'm generally surprised like he kept that job for so long, but he also dropped out of high school, and that's a whole long story. But
yeah, I mean, basically, just like, well, I mean, that relates to Ivan Dixon's character in Nothing But a Man. There's a couple of scenes of pride swallowing, of being like a proud black man, having to swallow your pride in front of white people. And, it, you know, there's this thing, you know, I go back to some of the examples I gave. It kind of takes you out, you know, like the movie starts. It's just these like working class black men. They're knocking off and then they're going to the bar. And it's just like this, like seemingly just like in a black neighborhood, a black owned bar. And you have these moments going back to Devil in a Blue Dress or Killer of Sheep or movies like that where it's just like, oh, it's just black life. And then kind of out of nowhere, you have this white element and it's kind of like, oh, damn. I wasn't used to seeing a white person in these films. And then they just kind of show up and just like, oh, that's right. And it kind of relates to just there's, you know, for a while. I mean, still to this day on the surface, it's very controversial to some people mm-hmm. who kind of haven't done their research. And obviously, just from my life choices and stuff like that, clearly I don't necessarily agree with it. But at the same time, I understand the thought of, like, integration to some degree was the worst thing that happened to black people. And from a financial standpoint, it's kind of true. Whether you take, I mean, when you look at neighborhoods like Rosewood or, like, mm-hmm. now suddenly it's weird how the Tulsa riots are just this new thing to people, even older than me. But, like, it's true. There were black banks, black businesses, black neighborhoods, and, you know, white people kind of left it alone. And you could look at it like, oh, we'll let you have this. But at the same time, from the black person's standpoint, it's like, okay, fine, let us have it and we'll thrive. And then, of course, through various, whether it's, you know, a woman screaming false rape or just white people having enough of like this black prosperity, eventually it all comes tumbling down. But it's, you know, There were these pockets, these areas of America where it's just like black owned businesses, black owned homes, and we just kind of did our own thing and we're left alone. And Nothing But a Man is definitely kind of like an early look at that, you know.
Like, I don't know, like, you know more about me. Like, was this playing like mainstream theaters? Was this a successful movie?
I guess I mean, it's even then and now it was considered an independent movie. So an independent movie in the early, this movie came out in 64, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, successful is a relative term. I mean, it wasn't any kind of like box office hit, but you know, there was clearly something about it where it stood the test of time. And it's like, this is a movie, like I don't own it digitally or on DVD, but I've seen it a bunch of times, and the only times I've seen it were at repertory theaters. So clearly, mm-hmm. 50 and 60 years later, it still gained notoriety enough to be played. So, you know, I look at it as one of those things. It's kind of like a cult status movie, but I don't mm-hmm. know if it was I'm using air quotes here, successful.
Oh, okay. Because this feels like it'd be perfect for a Criterion or someone like that to pick it up and make sure, like, people know about this, because this is just like I said earlier, it feels kind of like almost like a little French New Wave. This is like a pure slice of life.
Yeah, it is. You know, to be honest, I saw this in the theater in 2013, and then from that point on, I saw it again at Film Form. It was kind of doing. I live in New York City. For those of you listening who don't know. So there was, you know, anytime like an older film starts doing the repertory theater rounds, that usually means it was gonna have some kind of DVD or Blu-ray release. Obviously, Criterion being the top, but then you know, there's other folks like Kino Lorber or Milestone or even Blue Underground to kind of a lesser extent, but folks like that. And I was just sure that, oh, okay, it's doing the repertory theater rounds just like Killer of Sheep was, just like Army of Shadows was, just like all movies like that. And it ended up not being released by Criterion or like a big, you know, company like that, to my surprise. But
yeah, because like for a while, this like because I think it's out of print currently, and like it went from like $20 or so to like $60 last time I checked.
Wow.
Yeah, I think this is the earliest movie I've ever seen with like having where like they like the main character has like a kid out of wedlock. Sure, my Catholic education is showing, but
oh.
Yeah, but like this scene, this like this very frank depiction of like Duff has a kid from a previous relationship, like that's I haven't seen that in a movie like this old before. I've seen it in like blaxploitation stuff when Hollywood was like, oh, we can make black movies now, but I found it kind of a little jarring, because like
yeah,
of course it was happening, but it's just like just seeing it. Just this purely unfiltered, this look at, look at life. Was this in, this, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
And this, and like this other things like the minister or father-in-law, like with when he's talking about religion and asks him if he's religious, and this scene like him like. Them challenge religion is it's very mild and kind of brief, but like at the same time it's just like I don't think I've ever it just kind of feels like a little I was not expecting that, because like when I visit my family in West Virginia, like the religion is still like very a big part of their life, and like there's no really questioning it like where they live.
It's funny. The first time I saw this movie, I thought that myself about Ivan Dixon's character, in that it's like, wow, a black guy in the Deep South in the early 1960s, and you're just very like, that religion stuff. It's like, wow. Like, you know, because even, you know, my dad, I mean, my mother was from South Carolina, so that goes without saying, but my dad being from Queens, New York, and his family, even though like both sides of his family have roots in Virginia, my dad was religious. It's just one of those things where, like, from age, time you were born, it's just always like, yeah, you're Christian, you're Baptist. So again, another kind of like quietly, somewhat, I don't like to overuse the term groundbreaking, but like a quietly groundbreaking kind of thing. Because even, you know, I'm going back again. I know I keep bringing these movies up, but Nothing But a Man is definitely subconsciously paved the way for films like of like a Charles Burnett, or you know, Carl Franklin, who did Devil in a Blue Dress, and oh man, why is this other movie escaping me? The film before that with Bill Paxton, One False Move, goddamn. That you know, religion, even if the, I mean, well, religion is, To Sleep With Anger is a religious allegory, but a film like Killer of Sheep, it's not like the main characters say stuff like, oh, praise God, but it's like God and Christ are all over in the background of that film. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, Ivan Dixon's performance in general, just kind of like, he's slow, he's stoic, but also kind of like, slot. Like, he always has this, like, kind of like, I'm not sure. He always has this type of, like, grin on his face. This, like, he's a good guy, but there's still this, like, devilish grin that he, like, expresses, you know, that he'll kind of flash, you know, throughout the film. And yeah, it just fascinates me. Like, wow, someone of his age just is just kind of like blah about God and Jesus.
This like there's like some like other stuff like that's really connected with me like personal level, because it's reminding me of like my own family again. Like my family from West Virginia, they moved to Detroit because they were looking for a better job, and it's like, oh wow, like I never expected to ever see that, like, even mentioned in a movie. Someone from, like West Virginia is, I guess, technically southern. And if you ask them, they'll tell you it's the most northern southern state and most southern northern state. So, like, they're kind of, well, at least my family's kind of jokey about whether or not they're southern or not. But, But like, what's like talking about moving to Detroit for a job and stuff like that. So it's like, okay, I never. This movie has hit really hard.
And no, like this, well, that's how it was. I mean, it's crazy to think now if you're like our age, but back then, yeah. Going to the Midwest, specifically going to Michigan for a job, like that's what it was. And then, you know, the 80s hit, and, you know, I mean, I hate using such an obvious example, mm-hmm. but for those listening, I mean, Roger and Me, or forget it, before Roger and Me, a movie like Blue Collar is kind of an example of, it's funny. I can't be the first person to say this, but it's like Blue Collar and Roger and Me are good examples of like a good double feature where it's like Blue Collar was about, you know, the racial divide and then the economic divide that came through Roger and Me. It's like, so with Blue Collar, it's like, we'll separate the black and white workers who were both in the same struggle, but we'll put them against each other. And then Roger and Me comes in. It's like, okay, we'll just take their jobs and make them dirt poor. So, but yeah, no, for those listening who may not know, you know, a city like Detroit was where it was at to try to find a job just because of the automobile industry. And then, you know, it's kind of common sense what eventually happened. But yeah.
Yeah, like for me, like my grandma's aunt, not my grandma's older sister moved to Detroit with her husband, who was kind of like a more an angrier version of Duff.
Wow.
And a little bit. I won't get into too much detail, but kind of like that. And they moved to Detroit. And they had 10 kids, and then she eventually moved back with 9 kids. A couple of them started living on their own in Detroit. But
so now this slice of life, you know, black film. You've brought it up a couple times how. You know, you relate to this movie on a personal level. So should I give my Ivan Dixon story now? Is it a good time to?
Yeah, why not
do that? Yeah. So again, I've mentioned my dad on this podcast a lot, and when it comes to film, I mean both my parents, but my dad specifically was someone who kind of got me into film. And my dad is someone his taste in movies was always weird to me. So it's like on one hand, my dad was someone who like. The films of like a guy like William Greaves, who did a movie like Symbiopsychotaxiplasm, which is something that, you know, you guys can see through Criterion now. So like my dad loved the movies of like a William Greaves, or he'll watch movies of like Melvin Van Peebles and not just, you know, Sweetback, but like my dad was someone who knew about, you know, Watermelon Man or even a lesser known film like Don't Pay Us Cheap. But then at the same time, my dad would like Tyler Perry movies and like the young, when I was in my, you know, early 20s, that kind of irritated me because my dad was someone like, oh, wait, so you like good black films, but you also like terrible black films. I don't understand that. So there's always been this weird kind of like hole form where like my dad knew about certain semi-deep cut black films, but then like a lot of mainstream black films, and given his ideologies toward race and stuff, it's like, why do you, I don't understand why you like this movie. So I would try to fill in the gap. So like my parents, well, they're not from Connecticut, they lived in Connecticut for a long time. So anytime like the IFC Center or Film Forum or something was showing a black film that my dad may not know, so like A Screaming Man, I bought my parents tickets, and it's like, hey, let's go to Film Forum. You know, it's like their drive from Connecticut to New York City was like an hour and 15 minutes, so it wasn't that far. So it's like, you know, when Killer of Sheep was coming out, like, hey, let's go see Killer of Sheep at IFC Center. Let's go see A Screaming Man at Film Forum. Or when Black Venus, the Abdelatif Kashish's film about the Hottentot Venus came out, which was a huge bomb, both financially and critically in France. But long before he made Blue is the Warmest Color, Abdelatif Kashish told African Films, he, you know, made Black Venus. And for those of you who don't know, he made the film Secret of the Grain about this North African family Tunisian family living in France. So Nothing But a Man came out, and you know, for at this time, for health reasons, my dad couldn't get around a lot. He was on dialysis, he could get around, but just like, you know, walking around and traveling, it wasn't the easiest thing for him to do. So I went, I saw Nothing But a Man, and then I immediately was like, oh, my dad would love this movie because he loved Killer of Sheep and he loved the films of Carl Franklin, who I mentioned earlier. And I was like, hey, Dad, there's this movie. By this time, I was in my early 30s, the first time I had seen Nothing But a Man. I called my parents, you know, I told my mom about it too, but I was like, Dad, this movie, Nothing But a Man, It's actually, it stars Ivan Dixon, who at the time, I only knew him from Hogan's Heroes reruns. And my dad took this weird pause and he was like, Ivan Dixon? And I was like, yeah, why'd you say it like that? He was like, you know, your grandmother dated Ivan Dixon, you know, after she got divorced. And I was like, no, why would I know that? Like, the way he said it, he was just so casual. I was like, no, Dad, I actually didn't know that my grandmother dated a television star. And he was just like, yeah, you know, after your mom got divorced, you know, from my dad's father, it was like, you know, she was single for a little while. And then she went and, you know, she dated, and one of the guys that she dated was Ivan Dixon for a little bit. And then I talked to my uncle about it. My father and my uncle have different fathers. And I was like, Uncle Chip, grandma dated Ivan Dixon? He's like, yeah, you did. He said it with such pride, too. He's like, yeah, you didn't know that? He's like, no, I didn't know grandma dated a TV star. What the hell? And luckily, so when I saw my grandmother passed away in 2015, so I called her. I was like, grandma, you know that I'm into movies and TV and stuff. And you never mentioned that you dated Ivan Dixon. And she was like, oh, I don't know, I guess it just slipped my mind. Like, she said it so casually. And I just thought that was really cool. Because my grandmother's another one, just, like, she was no, like, cinephile or anything. But at the same time, like, just because of, like, limited television and limited film, like, anything that came out, you saw. So, like, I remember one time, just out of nowhere, I had a nice 40-minute conversation with my grandmother about Ben Gazzara, who was a TV star and a film star. So it's just, you know, a lot of people know him just for, like, he's known for either the films of John Cassavetes or he's known as the bad guy in Roadhouse. But, you know, it's just kind of cool that my, you know, 90-something-year-old grandmother just knew, like, to her, Ben Gazzara was a household name. But anyway, so, yeah, this movie hit home on a personal level because my grandmother dated the star of this, of the movie of discussion. And I actually wrote about this in for the Pink Smoke, because I'm not gonna say the movie theater, but I saw the first time I saw Nothing But a Man was at a movie theater, and it was hosted, the screening of the movie was hosted by Fab Five Freddy and Jonathan Demme, who were good friends, and they'd collaborated a couple of times. And actually Jonathan Demme's nephew Ted Demme was the one who kind of co-created/co-opted Yo MTV Raps. So there's a deep history with Fab Five Freddy, you know, in the Demme family. So when Jonathan Demme passed away, he is a Pink Smoke favorite. So the head writers of the Pink Smoke, you know, Cribs and Funderburg, and the contributors each kind of wrote a personal piece about Jonathan Demme after he passed away. And it doesn't get more personal than, you know, I met Jonathan Demme at a screening of a film, and I later found out that, you know, this film starred someone that used to date my grandmother. So it doesn't get more personal than that. So if anyone, you know, has time, go over to the Pink Smoke and check out the pieces on Jonathan Demme that, you know, we all wrote it about. So I wrote about the Talking Heads film Stop Making Sense, which is a Jonathan Demme film, but the piece eventually morphed into kind of a piece about Nothing But a Man and the relationship, the brief relationship Ivan Dixon had with, you know, my grandmother. So it was really fun. It was fun to write that. And just in general, not so much my own site, but Pink Smoke I guess I'm the air quote head contributor or the third mic to Pink Smoke. And I have been for over a decade. But it's like on that website, whether it's writing about my father, writing about my mother, writing about my grandmother, you know, who have all passed away, like Pink Smoke has kind of been that place where I kind of get that kind of writing out. I don't really do it so much on my own site. I mean, my website these days is pretty much just about movie comparisons. But yeah, Pink Smoke has become kind of like my catalyst for personal, super personal, you know, film writing. But yeah, so in so many, you know, ways, I've written about Nothing But a Man on the Pink Smoke. So that piece is actually would kind of be a cool little companion to this podcast we're doing right now. So
okay, yeah, I'll definitely put it in the show notes. But
oh, awesome, awesome! I'll send. Actually, while we're talking, I'll send it to you right now.
Okay. And you talking about how your family's so casual about it? My mom's side, my grandma's dad played piano for Billie Holiday briefly in the 40s.
Wow!
Yeah, and I was like 18 when they brought up, and I was playing cello for like 6 years at that point, and playing bass guitar for like three or four years at that point. And my family was like, oh yeah, and Gilbert played piano for Billie Holiday for a couple of years, as like as if that's it was amazing. Nothing. And then, and they knew I was playing music and into music and like jazz, but there's never thought to ever tell me that. And they're like, oh yeah, and his cousin played trombone for Duke Ellington.
And then, that's so funny, man. Like, you know, honestly, as you talk, I mean, seriously, like the black middle class, not so much today, because that's a, you know, whatever, but like the black middle class are just like the black working class of the 40s, 50s, and 60s is still such an untapped, you know, area, whether it be in film mostly film. There's so many stories that could still be told, but I think people nowadays know from, like, whether you're Ava DuVernay or whatever her name is, who did The Chi and Queen and Slim and all that stuff. I just think, like beautiful, slow motion, sweaty black struggle is kind of like the thing, and it does make money, so obviously that's going to be a thing, but there's still a niche for like original untold stories for like the black middle class. But unfortunately, it doesn't involve, you know, like murder and lynching and stuff like that. So it's of no interest to a lot of film studios, both major and independent. So what are you going to do? But whoever's listening, I'm throwing it out there. There's so many stories of just like, you know, like the working class, like non, like, or like the struggle just has to be with, like, you know, owning a house, you know, for black people, which is kind of unheard of. But to some people nowadays, I think that sounds boring, but, you know, it really isn't. Like, as you talk about Billie Holiday, you know, Billie Holiday is someone who used to live in St. Albans, Queens. Like, that's where both sides of my dad's family is from. And St. Albans, like, is not, when it comes to Queens, it's not like a Jackson Heights or Astoria or, you know, Forest Hills or anything. Like, you know, St. Albans, Queens is minutes away from Long Island. So it's the kind of place where when you say St. Albans, a lot of even New Yorkers are just like, huh? But St. Albans is mostly known for two things. There's a mural underneath the Long Island Railroad stop. It's known as the St. Albans Mural. And people who have lived in, famous black people who have spent time living in St. Albans. And Billie Holiday is one of them. Count Basie is another one. Folks like that. Also A Tribe Called Quest. You know, 3/4 of A Tribe Called Quest are from St. Albans. Ali Shaheed Muhammad is actually from Brooklyn, but because the majority of the group is from Queens, he always gets grouped in as being from Queens, but he's actually from Brooklyn. But yeah, Q-Tip, Fife Dog, and Jarobi are from St. Albans. And I just think, you know, every time I go to St. Albans, like, you pass by the St. Albans mural of famous people who are either from or lived in St. Albans at one point. And it just makes me think of, like, that, you know, middle class, you know, black life, that, you know, when it comes to the arts, it like stories, like there's so many stories. Like, there's a million St. Albans, well, not a million, but there's a St. Albans in probably almost any state, and there's so many stories to tell. Like, I look at all my family's like old photos, and just, you know, even like internal, if we're gonna get into race, there's internal racial stories in black families that have nothing to do with white people from a direct standpoint, just like colorism. Like, my grandfather's side are all super light, like tone-wise. If you saw people on my dad's side of the family, if it wasn't for their lips and noses and nappy hair, outside of that, you'd think they were white. Whereas, like, on my grandmother's side, like, they're dark skin. And at this point, a lot of people know that, like, there's a lot of colorism struggles within, you know, blackness. And obviously that indirectly has to do with, you know, the spell that white people have put on some black people. But if you take white people out of the equation, there's a lot of racial stories that just, you know, with black people. And Spike Lee kind of touched on it with, you know, In School Days, which is a very true thing, which you'd think there'd be so many stories told about that. Cause I went to a historically black college, and it's like, it's true. Like, there's sororities. We're not, and fraternities, like the Alphas and the Qs. It's like the Qs are super dark skin. The Alphas are very light skin, or just like in with the sorority, like the AKAs are very, very light skin. And then I can't think of another female sorority, black sorority, but it's like, they're very dark skin. And it's just like, it's so deliberate. Like, you have to know you're intentionally only crossing light-skinned black people. Or on the flip side, with the Qs, it's like, for the most part, you have to know you're only crossing the really dark skin, and perhaps that's like a comment or a fight against, you know, the lighter skin, you know, fraternities and sororities. So, you know, I mean, I'm rambling, but yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of black stories to be told. And you'd think after a movie like Nothing But a Man, or even maybe years later in the 70s, Killer of Sheep, that it would have spawned more films like that. And, you know, as I talk, it's weird because it's like these movies like, say, Nothing But a Man, you know, it wasn't even told by a black filmmaker. It was told by, like, a white European filmmaker. Or even years later, a story of kind of day-to-day black life. Like a movie like George Washington, which is told by David Gordon Green, which is so weird to say because nowadays David Gordon Green is a white filmmaker. He's known for, like, Halloween or Pineapple Express or co-creating, you know, The Righteous Gemstones or Eastbound and Down. But it's like his first film was like super, super black. You know what I mean? And yeah. He brought along some of the cast members from George Washington show up later on in, like, you know, like Eddie Rouse, who actually passed away. Eddie Rouse was in just about all of David Gordon Green's films before he passed away. Or some of the young black cast in George Washington showed up later on in movies like Undertow and stuff like that. Yeah, I think black filmmakers, studios, both independent and major studios, are just independent and black filmmakers who want to tell, like, the typical black stories. I don't mean to sound so, you know, arrogant, but it, I mean, the facts are out there. Just look at any popular black film. It's just kind of all from the same branch of black struggle. So
yeah, and Nothing But a Man is also, you know, about that, but that's not the focus. Like, it's
exactly there's that scene at the gas station and stuff like that, but at the end of the day, it's mostly about, like, black love and you know, kind of overcoming, like, you know, like, struggle, not race struggle, but just, like, hey, like, I mean, the movie ends, like, I think the final words of Nothing But a Man are something along the lines of, like, you know, when he gets back with his girlfriend, he's like, you know, it's not going to be easy, but, you know, but we can do it, you know what I'm saying? And it has nothing to do with racism. It's just more like, this is our own struggle, this is our own story, and it's not about white people. It's like, we have our own, it's like, hey, we've inherited a kid that I didn't even know I had. I got to find a better job. You have to find a job. Like, that's like that's the battle. It's like, we're not fighting the Klan. We're not fighting white supremacists. I mean, in an indirect way, they are fighting white supremacy. But directly, it's about, like, you know, this is our own story. This is our own tale. So,
Like, another detail connected to my family is my dad's family in West Virginia. They went to a colored school for a long time. Like, West Virginia took a little bit, like a lot of southern states, to fully integrate. And my dad went to, like, a black school the black school until he was about, I think he was 10 or 11. So this was, like, late 60s when, like, his part of West Virginia finally, had built the integrated and, like, changed the rules around to allow integration.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, like, because people, I mean, people in general, like, you know what I mean? Like it's the way it was talked about. It's like, oh, that was 100 years ago. Like, no, it wasn't. Like, it was my parents' generation, literally.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, I mean, I tell people all the time, like, a story my mom used to always love to tell this story, which is, like, such a traumatic, it sounds traumatic to me, but it's like, you know, this is my mother who only passed away last year. And she remembers colors only signs. You know what I'm saying? It's not that far removed. Like, I'm the son of someone who, when my mother was 5, she drank from, because she didn't pay attention to the sign, she drank from a white only water fountain, and this random white guy grabbed her. And then my grandfather, her father, who was also very light skinned, he was actually biracial, but he still looked black, you know, that light-skinned black person. He grabbed this white guy and attacked him and went to jail. So it's like, I'm literally just a generation from that. You know what I'm saying? People always just assume it's like, which is why I always take personally when you hear that classic white supremacy saying of, like, hey, slavery was this many years ago, like, get over it. And it's kind of like, you have to be it's like, you're either an idiot or you're just being antagonistic. Like, those are the only two explanations when you say something like, hey, slavery was, you know, this many years ago, you know, get over it. You know, hey, my family came over from Italy or Ireland, and they, you know, made a living for themselves right away. And it's like, are you don't really think that, do you? Or maybe you do and you're dumb, or you know the history and you're just being antagonistic and you're trying to get a rise out of someone, so.
Yeah, or the classic, Irish people were slaves too.
Oh, don't get me started. Yeah, the whole Irish people. Like, well, it's that's the original All Lives Matter. It's like, well, Irish, blah, 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 blah. It's like, all right, great.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you knew struggle, and then you became, you eventually became the police force, and then you became this racist institution. So, congratulations. Good for you.
Yeah, and going back to your thing about colorism, like, my dad's family, they're lighter skinned. And so, like, right. Whenever, and like my grandma was telling me, like, whenever, like, someone would have to go into town or go shopping or go, like, drop off a bill or something like involving local government or whatever, like, they would send the lighter skinned ones because it would be, they'd have an easier time.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Or if someone had to come over to the house to fix something and they were white, they would have like the lighter skinned ones talk to the white person and interact with them and have the darker skinned ones, no, not home or somewhere else.
Absolutely. It's so funny how like just, you know, my mom's side is from the South. Like I don't really know them too well. I mostly know my dad's family, both sides, and that them pretty much being from like, not like specifically Queens, New York, but it's just funny how like generations before them, like how so many stories from like, you know, Los Angeles, or in your case West Virginia, in my case you know, New York City, how it's just like a lot of the stories are still the same, you know. It's very very interesting. They're so different, but you know, still the same. It's kind of cool, or not cool, depending on the story. But
yeah, I know what you mean. So yeah, nothing but a man. It's on YouTube, and
I like to say, so when something is on that, I like to say it's on a certain particular video platform that you might be able to find. Just because, you know, I although at this point I think there's a couple of different videos of Nothing But a Man on YouTube. So it's like, I mean, if you take one down, I think there's still two or three up. There's like two full ones, and then there's another. I think there's another one. Broken up, so it's easy to find. It's not that at one point it was, but now it's easy to find. So,
and the DVD is floating out there, just prices vary, and hopefully it will get a resurgence. But who knows? I don't know. I really hope it does. And the other movie, next movie is a movie he directed. I think I didn't check the year because he directed only three feature films.
Yeah, a couple of TV, yeah.
Director a whole bunch of TV, and because when I used to write for Cinema Knife Fight before the site crashed and they lost all their data, like maybe three or four TV shows or episodes I reviewed, Ivan Dixon directed, just by accident. Like by accident, I didn't even choose on purpose. It's like the episode I picked is like, oh, Ivan Dixon directed this, cause, like he is all over the place, but the movie we'll be talking about is The Spook Who Sat by a Door.
Yeah.
Based off a book by is it Dan Greenleaf? I forgot his name already.
Hold on, let's look that up again so we
Sam Greenleaf.
Sam Greenlee, yeah.
Greenlee, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the book is from 1969. It's and I haven't read the book. Have you read it?
Yes, I have.
Oh, okay. Is the
movie no, I'm not going to be one of those guys. I read the book after I saw the movie. I'm not one of those. Like, oh, I read the book first. No. The movie was very familiar to me for years, and then wow, 2011 or 2012, I realized I hadn't read the book, and then I saw this guy, this other black guy on the train reading it, and I was like, why don't I just read this book? So, yeah. So I saw it years and years after seeing the movie, but still.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But, is it some, like, did Ivan Dixon and, keep, similar to the book, or does it, like, or do you not remember that much?
No, it's somewhat similar. I mean, I think by the time the book came out, and I mean, by the time the movie came out, and the movie is still quite revolutionary, it definitely, adhered to the more like Sometimes I hate using the term blaxploitation because I don't even know. I don't like calling The Spook Who Sat by the Door a blaxploitation film, but it's definitely, just from like a style wise and like clothes wise, it definitely plays into other films of that ilk that came out at the same time. But yeah, the spirit of the book is still there. I mean, the book, the movie, it's quite revolutionary. Literally, it's about revolution.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like Gunter and Hess, where it's like on the surface, it looks like a blaxploitation movie, but when you actually watch it, you realize, oh no, it's not that at all.
Sure.
Except yeah. I think, except this had a better fate than Gunter and Hess had.
Right. Sure. Yeah. I do. I always have to point out. I love that. Look, the you could do a whole episode on the relationship between the movie Belly and modern black movie audiences, but the end of Belly, I haven't found it, but I'm just so certain that Hype Williams took the end of The Spook Who Sat by the Door from Belly. I mean, obviously I did a side-by-side comparison of it, but it's just like, you know, you have DMX who's sent to kill this black leader, you know, in the film, and then the way he's like, he's just pointing the gun at him, you know, he's like struggling with to kill him. It's very similar to the end of the movie, The Spook who sat by the door. But you know, and Hype Williams is always someone who's talked about his influence. He's like, yeah, Harmony Korine and Basquiat and blah blah blah, all these people have influenced me. So I wouldn't be surprised if The Spook Who Sat by the Door was an influence just on the end, not the entire movie Belly, because Belly is it's a complicated movie, but the end is quite similar to The Spook Who Sat by the Door, in my opinion.
And there's another movie that I remember you did a side-by-side when the Black Klansman came out, the Spike Lee one, and was Spook Who Sat by a Door, and watching this movie second time, it's like, oh wow, Spike really borrowed a bit from this movie.
Yeah, and he's another one, as openly arrogant as Spike Lee can be, whether it's Chinatown or even certain Godard films, or, you know, obviously Night of the Hunter. Spike Lee is someone who, because he's another guy who loves movies too, and he'll say, like, maybe not right out, but he's just like, yeah, no, I got this scene from this movie, or I took this from that. Like, he's another guy who's fairly open about his influences as well, so.
Yeah, because, like, there's, and also, like, Chirac, I think, borrows a little bit. You know, Chirac is an adaptation of Lysistrata, but there's some, it feels a little influenced by Spook So I Adore in certain ways.
Sure.
Although I don't remember, we watched a movie like 6 months ago, and I kind of already forgot a lot of it, besides thinking it's not that good.
Thought what wasn't that good?
Chirac.
It's that's you're being nice, but I think that movie's been bashed so much, and it also gets grouped. It's one of those things where when Chirac came out, like, there's nothing. What it's like to quote Dave Chappelle in season one of the Chappelle Show. It's like, what could be said about that movie that hasn't already been said about Afghanistan? it's been a movie that's been kicked so much. Like, I'll just. They're right. It's not a good movie, but I actually saw Chirac pretty late in the game, so at this point, I just feel kind of dumb seeing the movie late in the game and be like, oh, this movie's terrible. It's like, we know. Who doesn't know? I am fascinated by both black and white people. There's a small group of folks who genuinely, outside of just being like forced ironicism and just forced contrarianism, there are people who defend Chirac, and I find it interesting, but... Oh, yeah,
I know a lot of people who that's like one of their favorite Spike movies of like
a lot. The last, you use the term a lot. Wow. Okay. It's just it came out during this rough time where it's like, you know, Red Hook Summer, The Sweet Blood of Jesus, Chirac, and The Sweet Blood of Jesus I think is a really good movie. So I don't like to criticize his recent bad movies because I think they kind of all get looked at as one jumbled movie, whether it's like Sweet Blood of Jesus, Red Hook Summer, Chirac, they all get grouped in together, and I think
Did you skip Old Boy on purpose?
I did.
Okay.
That's such a... Old Boy is like his... when you take the filmography of John Carpenter and you look at, you know, Memoirs of an Invisible Man, that's the only John Carpenter movie that doesn't say, you know, John Carpenter's Invisible Man. everything, you know, like, okay, whether it's John Carpenter's Ghost of Mars, John Carpenter's The Thing, like, that's the one movie he took his name off of. And, you know, while I think that's a good movie, it's definitely, like, the most non-John Carpenter film of his, when he was in his prime. So, it's the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, okay, yeah. So, Spook is Set by a Door. It's a fictional account of the first a black CIA employee. Mm-hmm. And he worked for CIA for 5 years, and then he goes back home to Chicago and tries to start a revolution.
Yep.
And the first one, like, I fucking love this movie. It's just,
yeah, it's great.
Yeah, like, it's so funny, it's so violent, it's so dark, it's so, it's just so, like, this, like, every scene feels extremely thought out and very pointed, and, like, is pointed out, like, is this, like, make this, like, is like examining the themes on some level, like, mm-hmm. there's so much packed into this movie, and but it's also just so breezy to go through, because, like, I always, like, second time through, I was like, oh, it's over already. Like, because, like, it just flies by.
Yeah, and going back to what you said about Black Klansman, there's a similar revolutionary I mean, you talked about that side-by-side comparison I made, but it's sometimes, it's really the message behind it. It's why sometimes I get a little testy when people see a comparison I made and they're like, oh, this is basic. And it's like, I feel like you haven't seen either. You haven't seen one or both of the movies. So, because the whole point behind the comparison between Black Klansman and Spook Who Sat by the Door is, I'm not a gun guy. I'll never own a gun in my life. But at the same time, part of me, it's like, if other races of people, whether it be, like, well, obviously white people, but, like, Asian communities, Latino communities, it's like, hey, look, if other communities, generally speaking, are going to own guns, it's like, then, hey, black people, buy guns, too. Do it legally, obviously, but if let's not be behind the eight ball. It's like, if something is happening, if people are going to own guns, like, let's not be the one group of folks with our pants down. You know what I'm saying? So, again, I'm not going to own a gun, but I think, you know, other folks can, you know, I have other family members who own plenty of guns. And so it's like, and they own them responsibly. So, and I think that's the point behind the very, very final scene of Black Klansman and that comparison I made, where it's just like, hey, black people, take up arms, do it legally, do it responsibly. I mean, as long as this country allows you to do it, you know, use it, take advantage of it. Why not?
Yeah. Like, and like, I see a lot of people, like, sometimes fetishize the picture of Malcolm X with a rifle.
Yeah.
And he was definitely a big part of that. But, like, if you know Malcolm X's life at all, it's like, of course, like, he would have that opinion. Like, it makes perfect sense. But for me in my life, like, I don't like guns and will probably never own one.
Same. Yeah, exactly. But it's okay to have that opinion. It's like, hey, just like I was saying earlier, maybe if... I'm not going to name drop names, but it's like, if certain immediate family members around me own guns, maybe I feel a little safe because they do it responsibly. So it's like, I don't ever want one. I don't want one in my house, but it's like, it's nice to know someone directly that loves me that has one. Like, that's not the worst thing in the world. That's, you know, just saying, you know, you could tell in the tone of my voice, I'm treading lightly, but, you know, just saying, just throwing it out there.
Yeah. So, The Spook Who Sat by a Door, I love the beginning because you don't realize who Dan Freeman is. Like, he's not named until, I think they don't say his name until I put, like, until, like, about 10 minutes into the movie. And the CIA is basically, like, so they look better, is, like, to look like, oh, they're inclusive, to have one black person work for them, basically, is all reason for, like, hiring a black person to begin with, which is just, like, funny and sad at the same time. And, like, the main character in the movie is just hidden in the background for about 10 minutes, which is part of the point of being a good agent, is blending in. And it's just so clever, and it's like, I was definitely paying attention to, like, just trying to see, like, do we ever get to see, like, a single shot of him until he's introduced. And I don't think you do. He's just always is hidden somewhere.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how, like, somewhat innovative things don't always get recognized. Like, I'm sure, like, this point you're making it probably took a while, like, for folks who are outside of the, you know, like, not directly related to the movie. I'm sure it's like little things like that don't get recognized until like years later. You know what I'm saying? How, you know, I think that's really cool, but also not cool, where it's like this really quietly subtle progressive thing isn't even noticed. You know what I'm saying? Like, but that's kind of the risk you take sometimes as like a filmmaker or storyteller, whichever.
Yeah. And so, yeah, Dan Freeman, he basically he worked for CIA for 5 years, and I think so the reproduction sector, and you see, like, there's a cut to him making copies, which is a good little joke, but like, so he just does that for 5 years, and so he moves to Chicago, and when he moves to Chicago, he immediately, because you don't know his plans for a while, because like the whole time, he's basically being Uncle Tom to the people in charge.
And which, like, is an interesting thing about that story, how some, this could be a whole other episode, how the term Uncle Tom might be one of the most misused terms in the black community. I mean, it's one of those, like, it is what it is now. Like, you can't even go back and retroactively do it. Like, it's just kind of that go-to thing, but it's true. It's one of those things how it just tells that thing how, like, there's a black person who you think, because maybe they have a certain job or they move a certain way or talk a certain way, you think they're, I'm using air quote, the term Uncle Tom, when it's like, in fact, not necessarily. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. And like the other candidates are like giving a hard time and like goofing off and stuff. And like the whole time, like Dan Freeman is the smartest one.
Yeah.
And he's quietly the smartest one, which, like, that's why he's being quiet and just studying and he's not going out to party. He does see a prostitute, but like outside of that, like, he just stays out of trouble. He's not loud and abrasive, you know, like, and like there's this like, great scene in the hotel where they're staying, and I don't think I wrote it down, but there's this great moment where he's being called out and he's like, they probably bug the room, and all the other guys are like, just assuming like he's crazy, but then, you know, Dan's proven right.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So, what do you like about this movie?
Besides stuff that I've already said, that just, I guess, I don't know. I don't want to repeat myself, but I guess just see everything that I've said leading up to you asking me this question, how it's just, you know, it's like a sly tale of revolution. It's a play on the whole ideology. I'm not just, let's not branch off to a million things, but just the whole ideology behind the Uncle Tom, and just, again, just that internal battles between white people outside of, you know, black and white people, but just, and it was also one of those early, like, going back to what I was saying, when I sometimes grit my teeth when I include black films in the blaxploitation, because some blaxploitation films are incorrectly categorized as blaxploitation, but it's like,
yeah,
it's one of the more respect. Wait, this was 1973, right?
Yeah, same year as Gun.
Yeah, so it's, it's one of, like, the whole blaxploitation thing was way after the fact. We're talking like the later 70s when they got a little silly and cartoonish, but it was one of those like early respectable cult black films where it's kind of like, you know, white cult film, you know, like the kind of like white cult film people that loved Shaft and stuff like that, or like Dolomite, you know, where it's like black people love this movie too, but like true black, like black folks that were really in the know had this kind of up on white people, where it's just kind of like, yeah, white people know about Spook Who Sat by the Door and they love it in a respectable way, but it also kind of doesn't necessarily speak to them the same way that it would black folks. If I'm making any sense,
No, you are. I don't know really how to talk about this movie because there's so much to it,
right?
And also, I don't know how famous it is currently. Because, like,
again, it's like cult movie status. I might say so.
Yeah, so part of me feels like I don't want to spoil some of the twists and some of the things that get revealed. Because you can't find it online in some places. There is a DVD out there. But, like, you know, basically it's... No, like it's just also it's like it just feels so modern, because like the whole because there's a whole sequence of like the cops killing and killing someone, and I think Shorty's supposed to be a kid. I'm not, I wasn't sure.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
yeah, and like that's now highly publicized. Not publicized. What's the word? It's been like co-opted into like mainstream, not co-opted. Because like police shootings now is like everyone knows about it, but like it has always been happening, and like I can't. And this is like this, for me, it's like the earliest movie I've seen that like directly deals with it, and it's just like a great reminder of like no, this has always been happening, in this mainstream news just didn't always you know want to talk about it or cover it until
yeah. Oh, recently. Oh, okay. So that's what I want to say. Yeah. So that's another thing too. Wow, you just brought up a point. So exactly, like the whole idea of like police brutality. I mean, I was 10 when the Rodney King thing happened, and you know, I remember both of again going back to my parents. I remember both of my parents kind of being confused that like both of their reactions to white people's reactions to Rodney King, because it is true on a I'm generalizing, but when the whole Rodney King tape came out. You know, white people, their reaction was like, oh, I can't believe this. This is ridiculous. And then, like, black people of my parents' age and era are just like, are you serious? They just happen to have a camcorder. It's like, you don't think this is, like, an anomaly or something new, do you? And that was it. It was just like, to kind of, like, to sum it up, it was like, to white people, it's just like, are these cops beating up this white person? This is crazy. Where it's like, black people's reaction, like, are these cops beating up this black person on television, it's just little it's differences like that, you know.
Yeah, and it's just always shocking, like going back to Black Klansmen, when people were like, wait, white women contributed to the Klan too? It's like, what did you think some of them were doing, the ones like were married to the Klansmen or dating them? Like, of course they were helping out.
Look, this goes back to what I was saying about the whole like between Rosewood and Emmett Till and stuff like that, like just the facts are there. And let me just be clear too, these are facts that were taken decades ago, so who knows? Like, just the idea of, like, you know, documenting public lynchings, how many undocumented lynchings do we know about, you know what I'm saying, that were just about, like, questionably if it happened or not, but regardless, if like a white woman felt uncomfortable around a black man, a lynch, you know, it's like, hey, this, he whistled at me or he looked at me for too long, like, wait, what, let's string him up, like so yeah, so let's not just, you know,
like one of my favorite things in this movie is the running joke of the CIA people. I don't think they're ever named, like, and they are, like, a couple times they comment, oh, they are good. They make good athletes. Or make comment that, like, they make that joke a few times, and every time it gets funnier and funnier. And then at some point, you see, like, the guerrillas do, a mission in Chicago. And you see, like, oh, they are actually good athletes. So it's like a weird, like, it's a weird racist joke, but same time, it's like, but it's kind of true in this case. They are actually good athletes.
Exactly. You keep bringing up reasons why I like it, where it's like, this movie is universally loved, but there's also certain things, like, where, like, black people can kind of laugh at themselves in a safe space, where it's like, hey, this is fucked up. Well, it's also kind of true. Like, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I'm not gonna say anymore, but it's like one of those things where, yeah, no, it's true.
And, a movie that I'm endlessly fascinated with, and I don't love, but I like a lot, but it's complicated. Coonskin, I think, borrows from a certain scene when they tie up the guard and do the blackface thing and give him acid. I'm pretty sure Bakshi references that in Coonskin with I think it's a police chief character in the whole crazy sequence.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like folks who haven't seen this movie, this what we've said in this episode is like enough to. I mean, I don't know. You kind of hear both of our excitement. I think this is an endorsement enough to kind of seek it out. This is another movie that you don't have to search for very far. Like, if you don't want to pay to stream for it or buy the DVD, it is up on, you know, YouTube. So
yeah. And I don't know, like, this is going back to you're saying about like skin color and pretty Ricky. Is it Ricky or Willy? The light skin guy.
Oh wait, hold on. Yeah, but go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, like my favorite moments is his speech about like being light skinned and like people assuming he's white, and it's just like as someone
pretty Willy. Pretty Willy.
Pretty Willy. Yeah, and like during that whole scene, like that just brings back to like from junior high to high school, like being told. Because I went to a private Catholic school for a long time, being told by white people that I'm not a real black person because I'm not dark enough. That pretty Ricky monologue just like every time hits very hard because that's what it's like in certain in at least my experience is that was kind of what's like just. People like being like, well, you're not a real black person because you went to Catholics because you're in Catholic school or whatever. It's like, and like as a kid, like, you can't really defend yourself against, well, I couldn't because I didn't really know how to defend myself from that. But like, you know, it's just a weird, I don't know. It's like, yeah, you get where I'm going with this.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely, of course.
Yeah, yeah. I'll leave it at that. There's just, like, so much to this movie that is also still, sadly, a little too relevant.
Yeah.
Which is very upsetting, just like the... Yeah. But, it's you can find it in places, and, I don't know if this is true, I've looked into it, but the FBI... Was the FBI trying to suppress the movie?
Oh.
I've seen like rumors of that because it kind of disappeared from theaters after it came out, and it was like kind of hard to find for a while. And then, like, there's a lot of theories as to why it got taken out of theaters.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I've seen. But it was like kind of hard to find and suppressed for a long time, and I think. I forgot to look it up. Oh, but Nothing But a Man, there's a part where someone calls Duff Trouble Man, and Trouble Man was another movie that Ivan Dixon made later on direct.
Yep.
Which is a nice little connector. But
yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, I haven't seen Trouble Man yet. I don't hear people talk about it as lovingly as they do the spooky stuff I adore. I'm sure it's still good.
Yeah, certain pockets kind of champion it.
Yeah, so, you've been a couple episodes, the, The Sweet Blood Jesus, She Hate Me, and, Chameleon Street. So, people can go listen to those. And,
Definitely.
I believe you have another podcast.
Yeah, of course. Check out Zebras in America. I mean, with this current situation, we're plugging away with episodes. We have a whole bunch in the stash, so we're back to being a weekly podcast, and Pinland Empire is back to being a weekly movie blog. By the time you're listening to this, my thoughts on Ken Loach's Sorry We Missed You will be up, and I also recently wrote about Bruno DeMont's latest Joan of Arc film, which is the sequel to his... Jeanette, the early years of Joan of Arc. So, and also we're kind of on lockdown. So, let me just say, Pinland Empire is I'm in my 11th year of doing it. So, if you go to pinlandempire.com, just click around and get lost because there's 10 plus years of stuff to read and look at. And Zebras in America, we're on episode 118. So, we have over 100 episodes. If you want to go back and listen to those as well. Check out all my old stuff on the Pink Smoke. I've been writing on that, for over a decade. And just, there's plenty of stuff relating to me that'll keep you occupied if you have time to kill.
Okay, yeah, and your site's great. I love the side-by-sides.
Thanks, man.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that.
Let's see, for me, I was just on Flixwise Canada talking about my favorite film series, Female Prisoner Scorpion, and me and Kessler have picked a topic for our next episode, which, no, I will say it. It'll be John Borman in the 70s, and I don't know when that'll be, but later on in the year, probably. And, nice. What's on my site, Jailhouse 701, Japanese Cult Cinema, coming up will be either a review of Onimasa, the Hideo Gosha Yakuza epic, or something on, or a review of Sex and Fury with and sequel. One of those two will be. I'm not sure which it will be. And the episodes around this time, because it will come out a week or two from now, it'll either be Burnt by a Sun, or it will be Clockers. It'll be Burnt by a Sun, or it'll be Clockers. I can't remember. I think that was it.
Cool.
And Marcus, thanks for your time.
Anytime, man. I have to run. As a diabetic, I'm having a low blood sugar right now, so I have to run and grab some food.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, but this is awesome, man. And yeah, obviously, you know, I'll be back on. So, yeah, this is a lot of fun. I love talking about both of these movies, as I'm sure you could tell, whoever's listening.
Yeah, and I'll see you guys next time. The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.